glanced at Billy with the vacant disinterest of a fellow who sees hundreds of men in hotel robes each shift. The disinterest would clear a little when he looked down at the bill to see how much the tip was, but that was all. Then the waiter's eyes widened in a look of startlement which was almost horror. It was only for a moment. Then the look of disinterest was back again. But Billy had seen it. Horror. It was almost horror. And the expression of startlement was still there. Hidden, but still there. Billy thought he could see it now because another element had been added. Fascination. The two of them were frozen for a moment, locked together in the uncomfortable and unwanted partnership of Gawker and Gawky. Billy thought dizzily of Duncan Hopley, sitting in his pleasant home on Ribbon Maker Lane with all the lights off. "Well, bring it in," he said harshly, breaking the moment with too much force. "You going to stand out there all night?"
"No, sir," the room service waiter said. "I'm sorry."
Hot blood filled his face, and Billy felt pity for him. He wasn't a punk rocker, not some sinister juvenile delinquent who had come to the circus to see the living crocodiles. He was only a college kid with a summer job who had been surprised by a haggard man who might or might not have some sort of disease. "The old guy cursed me in more ways than one," Billy thought. It wasn't this kid's fault that Billy Halleck, late of Fairview, Connecticut, had lost enough weight to almost qualify for freak status. He tipped him an extra dollar and got rid of him as quickly as possible. Then he went into the bathroom and looked at himself, slowly spreading his robe open, the archetypal flasher practicing in the privacy of his own room. He had belted the robe loosely to begin with, and it had left most of his chest and some of his belly exposed. It was easy enough to understand the waiter's shock just looking at that much. It became even easier with the robe open and his entire front reflected in the mirror. Every rib stood out clearly. His collarbones were exquisitely defined ridges covered with skin. His cheekbones bulged. His sternum was a congested knot, his belly a hollow, his pelvis a gruesome hinged wishbone. His legs were, much as he remembered them, long and still quite well muscled, the bones still buried. He never put on much weight there anyway. But above the waist, he really was turning into a carny freak. The human skeleton. 100 pounds, he thought. That's all it takes to bring the hidden ivory man out of the closet. Now you know what a thin edge there is between what you always took for granted and somehow thought would always be, and this utter madness. If you ever wondered, now you know. You still look normal, well, fairly normal with your clothes on. But how long will it be before you start getting looks like the one the waiter gave you even when you're dressed? Next week? The week after? His headache was worse, and although he had been ravenous earlier, he found he could only pick at his dinner. He slept badly and rose early. He did not whistle as he dressed. He decided Kirk Pensley and the investigators from Barton were right. The gypsies would stick to the seacoast. During the summer in Maine, that was where the action was, because that was where the tourists were. They came to swim in water that was too cold, to sun themselves. Many days remained foggy and drizzly, but the tourists never seemed to remember them. To eat lobsters and clams, to buy ashtrays with seagulls painted on them, to attend the summer theaters in Ogunquit and Brunswick, to photograph the lighthouses at Portland and Pemaquid, or just to hang out in trendy places like Rockport, Camden, and, of course, Bar Harbor. The tourists were along the seacoast, and so were the dollars they were so anxious to roll out of their wallets. That's where the gypsies would be. But where, exactly? Billy listed better than 50 seacoast towns and then went downstairs. The bartender was an import from New Jersey who knew from nothing but Asbury Park, but Billy found a waitress who had lived in Maine all her life, was familiar with the seacoast, and loved to talk about it. "I'm looking for some people, and I'm fairly sure they'll be in a seacoast town, but not a really ritzy one, more of a honky-tonk kind of town," she asked. Billy nodded.
She bent over his list.
"Old Orchard Beach," she said. "That's the honkiest honky-tonk of them all. The way things are down there until Labor Day, your friends wouldn't get noticed unless they had three heads each."
"Other ones?"
"Well, most of the seacoast towns get a little honky-tonk in the summer," she said. "Take Bar Harbor, for instance. Everybody who's ever heard of it has an image of Bar Harbor as real ritzy, dignified, full of rich people who go around in Rolls Royces."
"It's not like that?"
"No. Frenchman's Bay, maybe, but not Bar Harbor. In the winter, it's just this dead little town where the 1025 ferry is the most exciting thing to happen all day. In the summer, Bar Harbor's a crazy town. It's like Fort Lauderdale is during spring break, full of heads and freaks and superannuated hippies. You can stand over the town line in Northeast Harbor, take a deep breath, and get stoned from all the dope in Bar Harbor if the wind's right. And the main drag, until after Labor Day, it's a street carnival. Most of these towns you got on your list are like that, mister, but Bar Harbor's like top end, you know?"
"I hear you," Billy said, smiling.
"I used to go up there sometimes in July, August, and hang out, but not anymore. I'm too old for that now."
Billy's smile became wistful. The waitress looked all of 23. Billy gave her $5. She wished him a pleasant summer and good luck finding his friends. Billy nodded, but for the first time he did not feel so sanguine about the possibility.
"You mind a little piece of advice, mister?"
"Not at all," Billy answered, thinking she meant to give him her idea on the best place to start, and that much he had already decided for himself.
"You ought to fatten yourself up a little," she said. "Eat pasta. That's what my mom would tell you. Eat lots of pasta. Put on a few pounds."
A manila envelope full of photographs and automobile information arrived for Halleck on his third day in South Portland. He shuffled through the photographs slowly, looking at each. Here was the young man who had been juggling the pins. His name was also Lemke, Samuel Lemke. He was looking at the camera with an uncompromising openness that looked as ready for pleasure and friendship as it did anger and sullenness. Here was the pretty young girl who had been setting up the slingshot target shoot when the cops landed. And yes, she was every bit as lovely as Halleck had surmised from his side of the common. Her name was Angelina Lemke. He put her picture next to the picture of Samuel Lemke. Brother and sister. The grandchildren of Susanna Lemke, he wondered. The great-grandchildren of Tadeusz Lemke. Here was the elderly man who had been handing out flyers, Richard Crosskill. Other Crosskills were named. Stanchfields, Starbird.